I next met with Dr. Paul Paik. And to begin, we touched on an area of increasing interest in clinical research, systemic management of squamous cell carcinoma.
The overarching theme for the management of squamous cell lung cancer is that we just don't have a lot of standard treatment options available. And I think that's the frustrating part of treating these patients. In addition, the prototypical example of a patient who presents with a fairly central tumor who is pretty symptomatic, I still think is oftentimes the case. We are seeing more peripheral squamous cell lung cancer, certainly. What the difference is not exactly clear. But again, getting back to the idea of treatment, we just don't have as many options. Pemetrexed is not approved for the use in squamous cell lung cancer, not for lack of efficacy. And bevacizumab as well, for reasons of toxicity, is not approved either for the use of squamous cell lung cancer. And then, of course, the explosion of targeted therapies that we've seen over the past 10 years now since sequencing of EGFR back in 2004, in general, has not been available to patients with squamous cell lung cancer because we've come to understand that the biology is just in ways fundamentally different.
Can you talk a little bit about what's known of the biology of squamous cell carcinoma, particularly with relationship to mutations? You had a paper a couple years ago in Clinical Cancer Research looking at this. I think there's been data that's come out of the whole genome sequencing project looking at it. What's the bottom line right now of the spectrum of genomic changes in this disease?
Yeah, the bottom line is that they're very different from lung adenocarcinoma. The ones that we all find meaningful clinically, which would be EGFR mutations, ALK rearrangements, and now ROS1 fusions, RET fusions as well, because of the ability to treat these patients with EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors like erlotinib or with crizotinib and now ceritinib, these changes just don't happen in pure squamous cell lung cancers. And I think there's been sufficient data through the Cancer Genome Atlas work and through other centers that have done genotyping that in true sort of pure squamous cell lung cancers, really these don't happen in terms of mutation events. So they really are distinct in a biologic level. In addition, we have found other pathways that are important. FGFR1 amplification is fairly common in squamous cell lung cancer. PI3 kinase pathway changes are very common. And these two things alone delineate probably about 50% of squamous cell lung cancer patients, which again is different from lung adenocarcinoma patients.
Is it true that you don't see KRAS mutations very much in squamous cell?
Yeah, that's also true. So KRAS mutations are pretty uncommon. We have picked them up, probably around 1% to 2% in frequency. And this sort of fits also with the experience with picking up BRAF mutations, so sort of all along up and down the RAS pathway. So these oncogenic changes are not particularly common in squamous lung.
So the so-called master protocol, which there was a press release that just went out a couple of days ago saying it was launched. Dr. Dave Gandara talked about that on a prior program. And I think it's really exciting. We've been bringing it up in all kinds of colon cancer seminars, breast, just as a model of how to do clinical research nowadays. Can you talk about what the master protocol is and what your thoughts are about it?
Yeah, so the Lung Master Protocol is basically a multi-center clinical trial protocol template to be able to get as many patients access to clinical trials that are targeted, that are logical and rational, in order to validate some of these targets that we've discovered. It's being spearheaded by SWOG, the Southwest Oncology Group, and at this point consists of a number of different modules based on the genotype. And the good thing about the Lung Master Protocol is that these modules are not necessarily fixed in stone, and these things are going to be adaptable depending on, you know, what the data show later in the future. And for now, the Lung Master Protocol is based on some of the changes that we've discovered through the Cancer Genome Atlas. So FGFR1 amplification and also mutation and translocation events are part of it. There are a number of cell cycle changes that happen, and so there's a cell cycle inhibitor that's being tested for patients who have changes in this also. For patients who don't have any kind of molecular aberration that fits, they're going to have access to an immunotherapy, something targeted against the PD-1, PD-L1 axis. So the idea is that whatever the genotype testing shows, there's going to be something that's going to be available to the patient and something that's going to help to validate these drugs and these targets in the clinical space. And so the bar is relatively high. These are not phase one studies. These are all randomized studies against standard second-line therapy, which would be docetaxel.
I think it's really exciting. I think it should be so appealing to docs in practice. I mean, as you said in the beginning, there's so few options for this disease. To go into this study, get genotyped, and know that you're going to go into some kind of trial, even if it's the PD-L1 trial, to me is really something that should appeal to patients.
Yeah, I think you're right. You mentioned the important point, which is that everyone is going to get genotyped centrally. So everyone's going to have the results in hand. And, you know, in the end, that's a pretty empowering thing to have, that kind of deep coverage and the possibilities, not just within the Lung Master Protocol, but even outside of the box for the clinical oncologist to consider, is something that's pretty powerful.
And of course, the assay that's being used there is the Foundation One. So, you know, your former colleague at Memorial, Vince Miller, had moved over to Foundation One, and it's just amazing what's being done with this protocol and so many others. What about tests like Foundation One or next-generation sequencing or multiplex testing in the community? Does that make sense outside of a platform like the Master Protocol where you know exactly what's going to happen?
So I think that there are two ways to answer this. One is, from a practical standpoint, I still think we're a little bit far away from using this in routine practice, particularly for patients with lung adenocarcinoma. You know, the turnaround time is still something on the order of 3 to 4 weeks. And in a lot of instances, this is not fast enough for the key targets that we know have FDA-approved treatments for each of our mutations and ALK rearrangements. And so I think it's going to be a component of testing. And as the turnaround time gets faster, it will probably replace some of the existing methodologies. But there still is a real place for current generation tests because of the rapid turnaround time that's present and that's necessary when you have a patient who is symptomatic from their cancer and needs these results within, you know, 2 to 3 days or certainly within a week. The results that you get back from the panel are complicated. I think Foundation does a very good job, though, geared towards the community oncologist in terms of calling out what is clinically relevant and what may make sense in terms of clinical trials that are available. And I think that really is the way to go in terms of Foundation and other companies that are going to get up and running to try to aid community oncologists in terms of how to use these results. And I think also as community oncologists get these results more and more, they'll become, I think, more savvy also, certainly, with their interpretation of these results and with what to do about them. And in the end, I think there's going to still be that interface, and I think it'll help foster that interface between the community oncologist and sending patients to academic centers for clinical trials, since the results will be there. You know, there's not going to have to be a wait for something that might end up working.
So another squamous-related issue that kind of came out at ASCO is the anti-EGFR antibody necitumumab. Can you talk about what that is and what's been reported and what do you think it means?
Yeah, so this was a trial called SQUIRE. It was a trial randomizing the first-line setting patients with stage 4 squamous cell lung cancer to cisplatin-gemcitabine or cisplatin-gemcitabine plus necitumumab, which is this fully humanized monoclonal antibody against the EGF receptor. So the way to think about it is a fully humanized version of cetuximab, which we're all, I think, fairly common with. And the bottom line is that the primary endpoint was met, which was overall survival. And the hazard ratio they were looking for was somewhere along the lines of 0.85 in terms of improvement with the addition of necitumumab. And this meant that the overall survival improvement went from something like 10 months to 11 and a half months, so a 1.5-month improvement in median survival. So it was a positive trial, but there are some oddities that are associated with it that make, I think, the results a little bit hard, at least to conceptually internalize. One of them was PFS benefit, and there was also no increase in response rate. So it's a little bit odd, this combination of results. It would suggest that the therapy itself, at least while patients were on it, was not any better than placebo, and that the benefit somehow was manifested later on in terms of the survival benefit. Now, I really don't know what to make of that necessarily.
That's like the old immunotherapy explanation.
Right, right, exactly. And the other thing is that, again, the survival benefit was not that high. And certainly from the audience, the question was, particularly with the theme of ASCO with science and society, is this good enough? Is this clinically meaningful? And so is this something that we should support for approval. The data aren't terribly surprising. The FLEX study, which was chemotherapy with or without cetuximab, showed a similar improvement in overall survival but was not FDA approved. And a subset analysis subsequently suggested there was more benefit in squamous cell lung cancers also. So the results, I think, of this trial are not terribly surprising. The real question is going to be what the FDA thinks about these results and whether or not it's going to lead to approval.
I guess the other issue that comes into play is toxicity in terms of dermatologic toxicity. Yeah. Len Saltz from your GI group has been very vocal about the problems that's been seen in colon cancer, social stigmatization, et cetera. Is this agent about the same in terms of dermatologic toxicity?
Yeah, so it's about, in terms of versus cetuximab, the dermatologic toxicity was similar and certainly higher than as one would expect as seen in placebo. So this is the other issue, is that there is going to be an increase in toxicity in these patients and how that factors into the modest improvement in survival is going to be something that we need to consider and something I think that will need to be discussed if approval is met with the individual patient. The other thing is that we're just societally and as academicians in a different place also, where we are thinking more and more of the cost-benefit analysis to these drugs, particularly in light of the additional tools that we have to really try to go at which subsets of these patients are having real benefit and are we able to cull this out any better. And part of the presentation for the SQUIRE study was that this H-score, which was prospectively being tested now, and one that was derived from the FLEX study, ended up having no predictive value in terms of having high expressions of EGFR by immunohistochemistry. So that fell apart as well. So there's no biomarker to aid selection of patients for benefit.
So another related question I wanted to ask you about squamous cell. I saw a paper you did in Cancer Chemotherapy Pharmacology. This is something I've been kind of, we like to put in poll questions to see what people would do. Risk of hemoptysis in patients with a resected squamous cell with bevacizumab. What do we know right now about that? The concern, obviously, with bevacizumab has been hemoptysis, but yet, if there's no tumor in the lung, is that a consideration?
Yeah, so the data that we had presented, which was a retrospective analysis of patients who had undergone curative resection of their cancer and then subsequently went on to receive adjuvant bevacizumab, is that there was no increase in the kind of toxicity that we were worried about in terms of life-threatening hemoptysis. Actually, there was no increase in bleeding risk in general seen. And again, this goes to support the notion that it really is anatomic and structural issues that happen perhaps more commonly in squamous cell lung cancer than in non-squamous lung cancer that drives this risk. So there's a bleeding predisposition that's there. And when you give something that's targeted against the VEGF axis, this risk is higher in these patients. And I still think that's the case. And certainly the experience with one of the other trials that was presented at ASCO with ramucirumab that targets VEGFR also bears that out to be the case. There was no real increased toxicity in the squamous cell lung cancer patients that were treated with this compound. And so again, I think increasingly we're going to see data that this is really a structural issue and the exclusion criteria that we normally use, which is if someone has an active site of bleeding or a central tumor, these are really going to be the things that drive whether or not a patient should or should not get treated.
Can you comment on your current non-protocol approach to metastatic squamous? And I'm also curious about your thoughts on the data on nab-paclitaxel, which there has been some discussion and also published data suggesting maybe more of a benefit in squamous cell. What kind of algorithm do you do for first and second line therapy in younger, older patients, and where, if at all, does nab fit in?
Yeah, so for me, and for us institutionally, the de facto standard is platinum and gemcitabine in the first line setting. This is a derivative of the Scagliotti data in 2008. Second line would be a taxane that's given. I tend not to be particularly dogmatic about the selection of first line therapy, though, because in the end, we don't really have head-to-head data in terms of platinum gemcitabine versus these other doublet regimens that are used to suggest that one is better than the other. As you had pointed out, there was the randomized phase 3 trial of carboplatin and nab-paclitaxel versus carboplatin and paclitaxel, and the subset analysis showed that there seemed to be an increased benefit with nab-paclitaxel in patients who had squamous cell lung cancer, both from a response rate point of view. The hazard ratio was around 1.7 favoring nab-paclitaxel, and a PFS benefit also. This is currently going to be validated in a randomized phase 3 trial formally, but at least there's a signal that nab-paclitaxel may have some additional benefit in squamous cell lung cancers. We still don't really know why. There are various explanations, none of which are particularly satisfying, but that signal is there.
So are there situations where you would utilize it?
It's FDA approved now to give in general. So the way that I think about it is in patients where I really need their cancers to respond because they're particularly symptomatic, I may consider carboplatin nab-paclitaxel in the first-line setting just because of the response rate data that's there in subgroup analysis. And then certainly, you know, the other issues in the second-line setting for nab-paclitaxel versus paclitaxel or docetaxel remain in place. Does the patient have some kind of relative contraindication to high-dose steroids, for instance, to prevent an allergic reaction? And some patients do who are poorly managed diabetics, in which case nab-paclitaxel certainly is compelling. And then there are those patients who still in the end develop a hypersensitivity reaction to a taxane where nab-paclitaxel also has benefit. But outside of these, there's nothing in the data to suggest that it's better than the typical, you know, Cremafore taxane.
So a couple other areas I wanted to touch on with you. You mentioned earlier BRAF mutations, and I wonder if you could summarize what we know about the frequency, what kind of situations that these are seen, and particularly the issue of BRAF inhibitors.
Right. So BRAF mutations happen largely in patients who have lung adenocarcinomas. In aggregate, the frequency is probably around 3% if you add up all of the different kinds of BRAF mutations. And one of the surprising things that we realized is that the BRAF mutations that do occur in lung adenocarcinoma, about half of them, only half of them, are the classical BRAF V600E mutation that you see in melanoma. And this is important because as a result, only half of these BRAF mutations have a chance of responding at least to some of these BRAF inhibitors, like vemurafenib, for instance, and other ones that are being studied in clinical trials. The other half are either modestly activating BRAF mutations or actually inactivating BRAF mutations, in the sense that if you look at downstream signaling, the signaling is actually less than you see with wild-type BRAF. And what we do with these, there's some data to suggest that treatment with dasatinib, for instance, or sorafenib may help, but this sort of remains in the clinical trial arena. But it is particularly exciting because outside of EGFR, it was one, and ALK rearrangements, this is one area, genotype category, where we have seen real responses to these BRAF V600E inhibitors like vemurafenib.
So you said it remains in a clinical trial setting. Does that mean you don't do it outside a trial?
No, I think it's reasonable if someone finds a BRAF V600E mutation to write for vemurafenib. And in the NCCN guidelines, there's now a table that shows various different kinds of genotypes and medications, drugs that are FDA approved in other cancers that would be reasonable to try in order to provide some support for insurance coverage and approval for these agents for things that have not yet formally been proven in lung cancer.
Another thing I want to ask you about, people don't seem to pay too much attention to anymore, but I see you had a poster or part of a poster at last year's ASCO looking at small cell. What's new there? You were reporting on mutations. What do we know nowadays about the biology of small cell and anything new in terms of clinical management?
Yeah, so small cell lung cancer, there have been a couple of different next generation omic analyses of small cell lung cancer. And unfortunately, not much was uncovered in terms of actionable hits. Like squamous cell lung cancer, FGFR1 amplification happens maybe in about 10% of these cases. Whether or not they'll respond to these FGFR1 inhibitors remains to be seen. There are a series of changes like MET amplification that can happen also in small cell lung cancer. Very rarely there are these MET mutations that can happen in small cell lung cancer. And so in terms of molecular differences, that pretty much, you know, sums it up. There's not a lot, and certainly less than what we saw with squamous cell lung cancer and less than lung adenocarcinoma. Right now, I think some of the newer developments in small cell lung cancer have to do not really with a genotype or a molecular aberration that you find, but more pathway-specific changes that we've seen. So there are studies of PARP inhibitors that are currently underway, and I think for now at least these remain the leading candidates in small cell lung cancer therapy.
Why don't we talk a little bit about your cases, beginning with your 76-year-old lady?
Right. So there was a patient of mine who was referred to me as a second opinion and then a transfer of care, someone whose stage 4 EGFR mutant lung adenocarcinoma was diagnosed way back in 2009 when she had a resection for stage 1B disease. There was a conversation about whether or not any kind of adjuvant therapy was indicated, and the decision was not to pursue this. Unfortunately, she ended up having recurrence of her cancer about a year later, predominantly in terms of bilateral lung nodules and also pleural involvement. So, as is clearly indicated, she received erlotinib at the standard dose of 150 milligrams, ended up having a response, but over the course of the next year and a half, just had a lot of difficulty in terms of the toxicity, predominantly actually from diarrhea. This required dose reductions all the way down to 25 milligrams daily and a fair number of dose interruptions, actually, in order for the diarrhea to quell. In the end, she, because of toxicity, decided just to come off therapy altogether. Even at 25 milligrams, she was having difficulty with diarrhea. And so she was treated with pemetrexed as her next line of therapy. And she did end up having a response to this, but in the end developed, at the end of last year, these ground glass opacities in her lung, as well as peripheral edema, and a lot of shortness of breath, and actually hypoxemic respiratory failure also. She required home oxygen as a result. And that's when I ended up meeting her, actually, in that setting. And the concern for me was that this was pemetrexed lung toxicity that we were potentially seeing. So we discontinued the pemetrexed, started relatively high-dose steroids, and then repeated a scan about a month later. And in fact, the scan showed big improvement. And clinically, she improved quite quickly to the point where she was off home oxygen and her dyspnea had resolved. And so clearly, I think in retrospect, this was one of the uncommon instances of pemetrexed lung toxicity that we do end up seeing that fortunately did respond to discontinuation of therapy. The question then was, well, what do we treat her with? You know, in that intervening time, her cancer did end up progressing. And it was important to note that she had never had resistance in terms of the Jagmin criteria on erlotinib. This was discontinued because of toxicity. And as a result, because of the FDA approval of afatinib now, I made the decision to try to treat her with afatinib to see whether or not she would tolerate it, because it is in the end a different compound, and whether or not we could get some additional benefit. And in fact, by cycling to afatinib, we achieved both. She did still require a dose reduction down to about 10 milligrams daily, but she's been stably on that without any diarrhea or rash. And her cancer has, as a result, also responded actually quite well. So she's doing very well right now on single agent afatinib.
So you mentioned all the problems she had with erlotinib, and I'm kind of curious, Dr. Mario Lacouture has joined your group, and you know, he's the person we always talk to about dermatologic problems. He's done a lot of research on this. Anything that he's come up with, or you know, that you've learned from him in terms of dermatologic toxicity with EGFR TKIs that has been useful?
He's been, I think, an enormous asset to both Memorial Sloan Kettering as well as the community at large in terms of how to manage these tyrosine kinase inhibitor toxicities. And so he helped to codify a regimen for patients in terms of remedies that they could do at home for the nail bed changes that they were seeing, onycholysis, and for the rash toxicity as well. And the important point that I think he made was that we need to really be pretty proactive when these symptoms are relatively mild in terms of starting agents and for high-dose steroids and also oral antibiotics to try to get this rash under control. And of course, the interesting thing that we've seen is that these side effects tend to flare within the first couple of months. And then the body, it appears, tends to get used to some of these toxicities as well. There will be periodic flares thereafter. But really, you know, this management of this toxicity has been much easier to do now that we have these algorithms in place, in part from the work that he's ended up doing.
Now, this patient received afatinib, and I'm kind of curious what your take is on it at the moment. In what situations, if any, are you going to use afatinib rather than erlotinib up front? Are you using it later on? Are you using it with cetuximab?
Yeah. So afatinib for me is still a gray area. There was, at this past ASCO, the combined results and analysis of the LuxLung 3 and LuxLung 6 trials, which did show that there was a modest overall survival benefit to the use of afatinib versus chemotherapy in the first-line setting, which for an EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor had never been shown. So this has not been shown for gefitinib or for erlotinib. Of course, the issue is that there's never been a head-to-head comparison between afatinib and any of the first-generation EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors either. And so for me, because of all of the issues that happen after a patient ends up crossing over, that data is not sufficient for me to replace erlotinib as the standard for afatinib. In terms of afatinib in the acquired resistance setting, we know that the response rate is actually quite low, somewhere around the order of 8%. And a lot of these are just retreatment effects, patients who have been off TKI for a while who are then started again. And we know that in these settings, patients, some of them are going to end up responding. So even that 8%, I think, is not a real reflection of the activity in acquired resistance. And certainly the biology, what we understand to be the biology of acquired resistance, also suggests that that's not going to be the case. The afatinib and cetuximab data is compelling. You know, the response rates are real. There's real clinical activity that we've seen. The problem with it is that it's pretty toxic when you put these two together. And that is a real limitation. And certainly back when we were exploring this in clinical trials, you know, there were a lot of patients who ended up getting pretty beaten up by the combination. So I'm reluctant to use that in the first line setting also, just from a toxicity standpoint. It is being studied formally in clinical trial format. And so we'll end up seeing what the results show. But again, the toxicity is the issue with this combination therapy.
And that's mainly the dermatologic issues?
That's right.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, we've been following the story of ramucirumab, the anti-VEGF receptor antibody in gastric cancer in our CME programs the last couple of years, and now it's been approved. And we did see data, I'm not sure I've seen anything quite like this before, looking at ramucirumab in non-small cell at ASCO. Can you talk a little bit about what they looked at and what you think it means?
Yeah, so this was a randomized trial of ramucirumab and docetaxel versus docetaxel alone in the second line setting for patients with non-small cell lung cancer. This was not histologically selected. And what they ended up showing in both the adenocarcinoma patients and squamous cell lung cancer patients on subset analysis for the entire cohort was that we sort of had the trifecta. There was an overall survival benefit, a PFS benefit, and a response rate benefit. So these things, unlike what we had talked about for nesitumab, all sort of made sense in terms of the benefit that ramucirumab was affording these patients. Again, the issue is one of whether or not this is high enough in terms of activity to receive approval. Like the nesitumab study, the improvement in overall survival was about 1.5 months, something along the lines of 1.5 months, so not that high. Now, on the flip side, there's not been a lot of new development in unselected second-line setting for non-small cell lung cancer. So this really is something that's new. But again, the question is whether or not the magnitude is high enough to warrant its routine use with, you know, the cost of the medication.
Any sense of the relative benefit? Obviously, it's different setting, different situation, but just globally, whether you have any take on the efficacy of ramucirumab in non-small cells opposed to Bev?
I suspect that it's probably going to be similar. You know, in the carbopaclitaxel versus carbopaclitaxel bevacizumab study back in 2005-2006 that Sanzler ended up publishing, the benefit also in terms of overall survival was something along the lines of 1.5 months, 1 month, something like that. The magnitude of benefit, I think, is similar. And I think it's just that targeting VEGF and the VEGF receptor in lung cancer has modest benefit. It's just that for the longest time, and certainly we've looked very hard to try to find some kind of predictive biomarker, we've failed in finding a predictive biomarker. And given all the work, I'm not too hopeful that we're going to end up finding something that's going to be able to hone down on who, you know, is going to have a lot of benefit to these agents.
Why don't we talk about your next patient? And I don't know, is this a real patient or just a scenario of the squamous cell?
No, this is a real patient. So this is, I think he's 80, actually. He's an 80-year-old gentleman who I saw after with stage 4 squamous cell lung cancer. That was his diagnosis. And he comes up from Maryland. And he was looking for other treatment options, basically. He had gone through the standard first-line platinum doublet chemotherapy, had ended up getting a taxane in the second-line setting, had gotten a vinca alkaloid in the third-line setting. So he was now in the fourth-line setting looking for options. And so we ended up doing two things. One is he ended up going on one of the immunotherapy studies, PD-1, PD-L1, and has had a good response to that. But the other thing that we ended up doing was this next-gen sequencing through our IMPACT panel, which again is similar to the Foundation panel. And one of the things that we found quite surprising from the results was that they were unlike what we were expecting for a squamous cell lung cancer. So the signature for squamous cell lung cancer is pretty prototypical in terms of what we'll end up finding. There's going to be a mutation or loss of function in P53, which is common, P63, and then these changes in the PI3 kinase pathway are pretty common. He had changes in the hedgehog signaling pathway, which was surprising, and which really has not been described before, certainly in the Cancer Genome Atlas. Where it has been described before, though, is in basal cell skin cancer as a target that's predictive for treatment against or with vismodegib. And in speaking to the gentleman, he did have a history of these basal cell skin cancers superficially that had been resected and, as a result, we think cured in the past. But what I suspect is going on is that he may very well have metastatic, one of the rare cases of metastatic basal cell skin cancer to the lung that was just really histologically impossible for us to diagnose. And I think this is important. In the community, there are going to be these cases. We've seen them refer to patients who have squamous cell lung cancer with basaloid features or basaloid differentiation. And the question is, what on earth does that mean? And to speak to one of my pathologists, basically it means that it kind of looks like a basal cell skin cancer. It's just hard to differentiate it. But there's keratinization as well, and that's what they mean. And so it's difficult histologically to tease apart basal cell skin cancers from this squamous cell with basaloid differentiation. And again, the distinction is important because I think there really is a subset of these cases that are actually metastatic basal cell skin cancer for whom vismodegib may be an option that you would not really think of if you were thinking of a typical squamous cell lung cancer case.
That's really fascinating. So I'm thinking that if this happens, and you know, we've covered the issue of basal cell and vismodegib a lot in the last couple of years, and I did some work and some research, and I was surprised. I thought, like, you know, you never see metastatic basal cell. And apparently, I guess maybe in more in the south or something, you do see it. Do you think it's possible that this is maybe happening more than we think?
Yeah, I think that it is. And certainly in the series that we've collected at Memorial, in this prospective testing that we've been doing with next-gen sequencing, there are something like 6 cases out of a series of maybe 200 or something that we've genotyped so far that have this squamous cell cancer with basaloid differentiation, or basaloid squamous cell cancer is another way to call it out. And most of these have these hedgehog pathway changes. So I think these are going to be more common than we have otherwise thought of. And I think that's going to be the real power, again, of this next-gen sequencing, is that it really is going to tell us, aside from the histology, what is really going on and what these cases may actually represent.
I never thought about it, but I mean, does, for example, Foundation One, would they pick this up?
Yes, they would. And they would both pick this up, as well as in their commentary section, note that these hedgehog signaling changes could be targeted either in clinical trials or with vismodegib.
From what we've heard, it seems quite effective, although I'm not sure it's that easy to give. Did you give this man the drug?
No, not yet, because he is still deriving benefit from his immunotherapy, so we've not yet had to pull the trigger on that. But that remains an option.
Have any of the 6 patients that you mentioned been treated?
Not yet.
Interesting. I'll be curious to know. I hear from the derm people that there's a lot of taste problems and quality of life issues with this drug.
Right.
So how about your last case, another patient with squamous cell?
So this case is a case of a woman who's a 69-year-old former smoker. She came to be diagnosed with stage 4 squamous cell lung cancer. She had one tumor on the right side that was fairly peripheral, and then she had a left-sided hilar mass also that was present, and no intervening mediastinal adenopathy. She came to me after being treated with first-line platinum doublet, had a response in the left-sided tumor, but not the right-sided tumor. And both had been biopsied, and both clearly looked like squamous cell lung cancer. couldn't really tell them apart. Second line setting with gemcitabine or a vinca alkaloid. And again, the left-sided tumor responded, the right side did not. I ended up treating her with nab-paclitaxel, and the left-sided tumor responded, but the right-sided did not. And so from the response data, it would suggest that the two tumors are actually different. And from the Martini-Melamed criteria, and this is a paper published in 1975, some surgeons from Memorial Sloan Kettering, it would suggest in the absence of mediastinal adenopathy that there is a chance that these are separate synchronous primary lung cancers. She ended up developing toxicity to nab-paclitaxel, anemia in particular, so that we really could not push it any longer. And so we did discuss with one of our thoracic surgeons an out-of-the-box idea. Maybe these are synchronous primaries. Maybe we should go forward and try to do some kind of surgery, since she was relatively fit to manage this, since the preponderance of data suggested that they were synchronous primaries. And so she ended up undergoing a resection of her right-sided lung tumor, actually fairly recently, tolerated it quite well, had a mediastinal lymph node dissection also, which showed no positive nodes that were present. Her left hilar mass remains quiet, actually, on CT and PET imaging. If there's recurrence, the plan is to give palliative radiation. But again, I think it's one of those instances where I think we need to be vigilant about these instances of synchronous primaries. This is not the first one that I've seen. And trying to think a little bit out of the box about the management of these cases, I mean, with the understanding that we can't give, I think, overzealous hope, but the implications are quite different, you know, in terms of potential cure versus incurable disease.
You've published on the issue of histologic markers in squamous cell. Are marker panels of any type helpful in this type of case in differentiating whether it's the same tumor or not?
For the immunohistochemistry, they really are not. And part of the problem is that while they are specific and sensitive in terms of being able to call them out against lung adenocarcinomas, there's still going to be inter and intratumoral heterogeneity in terms of the stain intensity of these markers that you can't reliably, I think, hang your hat on, you know, whether or not one tumor is P63 positive and the other tumor is P63 negative, if they're both squamous cell lung cancers. The thing I think you can hang your hat on is if you end up doing molecular testing on both and do demonstrate real differences in the mutations that are present, I think then that really gives you the best kind of evidence that these are different tumors.